Welcome to Missing the Mark, where we look for meaning in strange places. I'm Christopher.
Hi, this is part two of where I look at a talk that Sam Harris gave a number of years ago on forming a scientific morality. In part one, I talked about the introduction. Part two is where I look at the meat of his argument, where he really tries to do the work of forming a scientific morality. So, here we go.
But people of faith, really to a man, are worried that unless we have a universal moral framework, unless we have a sense that words like good and evil and right and wrong actually mean something, then humanity will lose its way. And I actually share that fear. And I should point out that not all atheists do, but I do. And I want to tell you when this concern was first seared onto my brain.
By the way, I'd like to mention, I rather respect Sam Harris for this, that he's actually taking this problem seriously. So there's a lot that I disagree with Sam about, and a lot he gets wrong, but he gets this right, this concern, the fact that he's concerned about this, at least at the time this was recorded, which was many years ago, that I think is something that we should all respect.
I was at a meeting at the Salk Institute, I believe it might have been one that Richard was at as well. And I gave a talk about morality, and I argued, as I will here tonight, that morality must relate at some level to questions of human and animal well-being. And the moment we admit this, we can see that certain moral codes are in fact worse than others. And I cited as an example the misogyny and sadism of the Taliban as an example of an orientation that was obviously less good than others. And at the end, another invited speaker approached me and said, how could you ever say, from the point of view of science, that forcing women to wear burqas is wrong? And I said, well, because the moment you admit right and wrong has something to do with human well-being, then it's obvious that forcing half the population to live in cloth bags and beating them or killing them when they try to get out is not a good way of maximizing it. And she said, well, that's just your opinion. And I said, okay, well, let's make it easier. Let's say we found a culture that was removing the eyeballs of children, every third child, say. Would you then agree that we'd found a culture that was not perfectly maximizing human well-being? And she said, well, it would depend on why they were doing it. So after my eyebrows returned from the back of my head, I said, okay, let's say they're doing it for religious reasons. Let's say they have a scripture which says every third should walk in darkness or some such nonsense. And she said, well, then you could never say that they were wrong. Now, you should know that I was speaking to a woman who was quite a sophisticated student of philosophy and science. In fact, she has since been appointed to the President's Council on Bioethics in the United States. She's one of 13 people advising President Obama on all of the ethical implications of medicine and progress in related science and technology. And she had just delivered a perfectly lucid lecture on the moral implications of advances in neuroscience. And she was especially concerned that we might be subjecting captured terrorists to fMRI-based lie detection technology. And she thought this would be a truly unconscionable violation of their cognitive liberty. So on the one hand, her moral scruples were really finely calibrated to recoil from the slightest perceived misstep in our war on terror, and yet she was totally detached from the very real suffering of millions of women in Afghanistan at this moment. So I view this double standard as a problem. And strangely, this is the erosion of basic common sense and moral goodness that religious people tend to be worried about. Now, I hope it's obvious to all of you, and will be even more obvious at the end of this hour, that religion isn't the answer to this problem. But it's inconvenient that the people who tend to agree with me about the necessity of a concept of moral truth are, by and large, religious demagogues and not our fellow secularists.
That in general, just incidentally, is a warning sign. Not always, but it's often a warning sign that when the people who are who are far more correct about an extremely basic issue tend to be on the other side. It's a red flag.
We're not atheists. So now how do we find ourselves in this situation? How is it that religious dogmatists and many, many scientifically oriented secularists agree about the limits of science? Well, it's thought that there are two quantities in this world. There are facts on the one hand, and there are values on the other. And it's imagined that these two are discrete entities that can't be understood in monistic terms. And it's imagined that science can't say anything about value. Science can't tell us the answers to the most important questions in human life. How should we raise our children? What constitutes a good life? In principle, science can't touch these things. Of course, everyone agrees that science can help us get what we value. I mean, once we agree that we value something, then science is a very useful tool. But it can't tell us what we ought to value. And so it's thought from the point of view of science that when we look at the universe, we just see one event following another. We just see a concatenation of causes. And there's no corner of the universe that announces certain events as good or bad or right or wrong. We make those judgments. But in doing that, we seem to be broadcasting our preferences onto a reality that is intrinsically value-free. And where do our preferences come from? Where do our notions of right and wrong and good and evil come from? Well, they clearly are the product of apish impulses and social emotions that have been drummed into us by evolution. And then they get modulated by culture. So you take something like sexual jealousy, for instance. We come from a long line of primate ancestors that were probably quite covetous of one another, despite the fact that everyone was covered with hair. And this possessiveness gets modulated by culture, and so we have something like the institution of marriage, say. And therefore, from the point of view of science, when you look at a statement like, it's wrong to cheat on your spouse, it seems like that statement doesn't really track reality in any deep sense. This is just how apes like us learn to worry when we acquire language. It's just conventionally wrong. It can't be really wrong from the point of view of science. This is just an improvisation we're doing on the back of biology.
Actually, there's a further problem. I don't want to get into too much. And this is something that is going to undergird a bunch of what he's saying, is that when we say that this is wrong, only some of us say that. And I'm not talking about religious, irreligious here, but even just keeping within the assumptions that he has given, only some of the apes say this. The ones who are cheating don't say that what they're doing is wrong. Some will, but lots of them won't. If you have any experience with people who are cheating, they come up with excuses to explain why actually what they're doing is just fine. So what he's not addressing, but which is highly relevant, is the fact that he's not talking about unanimous conclusions, but rather that there is disagreement about what the values even are. And this gets to the very core of it. There needs to be, therefore, if there is to be the sort of universal morality that he is looking for, there needs to be some way of resolving these disputes. Now, I mean, he's in a sense going to claim it's related to science and figuring out what is well-being. So I'm going to talk about that more later. But you can see it even here in his example that he's describing things in a universal way that's simply not true. There's disagreement he isn't addressing.
Now, this is where religious people begin to get a little queasy. And I think they should. But they see no alternative, by and large, but to insert the God of Abraham into the clockwork as an invisible arbiter of moral truth. So it's wrong to cheat on your spouse because Yahweh deems that it is so.
Two things. The first is a very minor point. Does he think that the scientific one is going to be visible? That the... you're going to see the moral arbiter? I mean, you know, given that science is, properly speaking, essentially an action, and therefore it's things that people do most of the time, you're not there to see happen. Anyway, that's just sort of a minor quibble, but calling Yahweh invisible is just a little bit silly, because, I mean, the law of gravitation is entirely invisible. You can't see the law of gravitation. You can see symbols which describe it written on a chalkboard, for example, but you can't see it. You also can't see gravity. You can only see its effects and infer its existence. But that's an even separate point. The other thing, and the more relevant one, is that he is leaving out natural law. He's describing the voluntarist version of morality, which is to say that things are wrong simply because God said so and that's the end of it, as opposed to, and I described this in my video about atheist morality, the real grown-up version of this is natural law morality. That is to say that we have a nature that has been given to us by God, and then things are good or bad according to how they work with that nature, which ironically is to some degree what he is attempting to discover through science. What he's really trying to do, and I'm kind of giving spoilers, I suppose, but it is to get at a natural law morality, that we have a nature, and therefore, because of that nature, some things promote our happiness and some things don't, and so on. And there's going to be a massive problem that's coming up with that I'll discuss later. But the funny thing is that he just doesn't even know that the primary form of Christian morality, and bear in mind, there are 1.2 billion Catholics and 600 million Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox, I believe, all of whom subscribe essentially to a natural law theory, whether or not they phrase it in exactly that form. The Catholics certainly do. And so he's got such a narrow view. He's talking about a small subset of Christians who go essentially a voluntarist route and say that things are wrong simply because God says so, and we'll, you know, punish people for doing them, and that's the end of it. Which, as I described in my video on atheist morality, and contrasted that with religious morality, is that that's the children's version, because that's really simple and easy to understand, and it's the only thing he knows. But I will give him points for trying to find the grown-up version on his own.
Which is rather odd, because in other moods, Yahweh is fond of genocide and slavery and human sacrifice. Now, I'm going to argue that this split between facts and values is an illusion. And my claim is that values are a certain kind of fact. They are facts about the well-being of conscious creatures. They are facts about the kinds of experiences it's possible to have in this universe. Now, in claiming that values reduce to the well-being of conscious creatures, I'm introducing two concepts, consciousness and well-being.
Oh, I'd also like to praise Sam Harris here for actually being relatively systematic in a sensible sort of way, where he is identifying the things that he is introducing rather than trying to slip them by. So he's not defining every term he uses, because that would be absurd, but he's actually doing a good job of doing what an honest man should and identifying what are the things that might be hard for people to accept or different than the way people think, drawing attention to them, and then pointing out what he means and justifying them. So I want to say Sam Harris here is doing a good job this way.
Let's start with consciousness. This, to my eye, is not at all an arbitrary starting point. Okay, imagine a universe without the possibility of consciousness. Imagine a universe just filled with rocks. Okay, there's nothing that it's like to be in this universe. Okay, the lights are not on in this universe. There's clearly no happiness or suffering. I would argue there's the concept of right and wrong, good and evil, simply doesn't apply. For changes in the universe to matter, they have to matter at least potentially to some conscious system. Now, what about well-being? It seems like the well-being of conscious creatures could be a controversial anchor for morality, but I don't think it should. Okay, here's the only assumption you need to make. Imagine a universe where every conscious creature suffers as much as it possibly can for as long as it can. I call this the worst possible misery for everyone. The worst possible misery for everyone is bad. If the word bad is going to mean anything, surely it applies to the worst possible misery for everyone.
Okay, and here's where we run onto the rocks. So, there are kind of several things that are really a problem here. The first of which is he's just assuming his conclusion. Bonus points to him for actually stating his assumption up front, but this is something you cannot justify scientifically. Because the word bad does not have to mean anything. Whether or not the word bad does in fact mean anything is the sort of thing you're supposed to go about discovering, not the sort of thing you're supposed to start off by assuming. If you start off by assuming it, you already have a moral measure. The second problem is he has not identified whether or not this even is a possible world. I understand that some people would say, like, well, you've described it, so obviously it could exist. It doesn't actually necessarily follow you could have a world with consistent rules in which that was the case. And that consistent part is necessary, because in point of fact, this actually reminds me a lot of artistic descriptions of hell. Because it's a problem you run into in descriptions of hell, that people who are burned forever in flames, but there's an immediate question that you need to ask. If there becomes gradually less of them as they are burnt, then they won't be burned forever, because at some point they're going to be ash that doesn't burn any further. They also won't be alive. If there is not less of them, then in what sense are they being burned? Because the whole reason burning hurts is because there is progressively less of us. Pains that don't mean anything. In the sense of pain which we come to know does not designate, you know, any change in our body, we don't tend to mind very much. At first, it grabs our attention, but over time we get used to that pain doesn't mean anything whatsoever. In the sense of it, you know, my body is perfectly fine after I experience that pain. It's exactly the same as beforehand. And so, you know, just the nature of how we work is that over time we just become less and less sensitive to it, because we know it doesn't mean anything. And not so much on a conscious level as a subconscious level, but in any event, flames that stimulated your pain, your heat receptors, but didn't actually hurt you in any way, any shape, or any form, would eventually become nothing to us. They just become background. So that's a problem you run into. And now, I'm talking about artistic descriptions, but so the idea is that you have an inconsistent rule here in order to really achieve this sort of suffering, that it continually hurts and you don't adapt to it because your nature is constantly changing so that you always feel this is fresh and are never remembering it, but it still has the suckiness of, like, it happened for more than just a moment, because if you could form absolutely no memories, then the pain that you instantly forget wouldn't really matter to you very much, because you've already forgotten it. The pain that didn't correspond to any bodily damage, I mean. So it's in essentially an entirely inconsistent system in order to accomplish something without having any of the effects of the accomplishment. And it is not at all clear he isn't talking about a similarly inconsistent system. He has not established in any way that such a thing could in fact exist, you know, could in any sense proceed. Moreover, and here we get to, one thing that obviously couldn't exist in this is a thing which took pleasure in another's suffering. Whenever you get utilitarian stuff, this is, you know, often called the utility monster. That is to say that in utilitarian argumentation, the utility monster is something essentially gets 2x suffering for, or 2x pleasure out of somebody else's suffering, for somebody else's suffering, x amount of suffering. And therefore, if they inflict large amounts of suffering, they get twice as much pleasure. And so your overall maximum pleasure is pleasure versus pain is actually going up. It's overall better. Now you can do individual normalization, all sorts of things to try to get around this. I'm not trying to debate utilitarianism here, but you run into this problem. He is assuming away the existence of a world in which people enjoy other people's suffering, because they would, you know, be deriving enjoyment, and it couldn't possibly be in their maximal suffering when they actually had enjoyment as well. Given how many people enjoy watching videos of people, you know, getting kicked in the crotch or falling off of things onto their crotch and so on, it is by no means clear that people don't enjoy other people's suffering. So he has not established this as an even possible world in a consistent sense. If you have an omnipotent devil who's able to do inconsistent things, then whatever. But he's not going to be positing that without some sort of religious belief. So he hasn't described what is, you know, even necessarily a possible world. And moreover, he has essentially just assumed his conclusion in calling this bad. You could do it as a stipulative definition just fine. But on the other hand, he's not. He's asking for this to be granted to him as true, in which case you actually already have a value that he's not going to attempt to establish through science. He's just going to leverage science to take this value and spread it out, roughly speaking. The other problem, by the way, with the whether this is a possible world and the conflicts between them, is that this world is not going to... I'm going to let him talk in just a second. But this world doesn't actually tell you anything about any sort of intermediate world wherein some creatures are happy and some creatures aren't.
Now, if you think the worst possible misery for everyone isn't bad, or that it might have a silver lining, or there might be something worse, I don't know what you're talking about. And what is more, I'm reasonably sure you don't know what you're talking about either.
Now, I'd like to point out, that's not an argument. It is, however, essentially a description of noetic knowledge, of direct knowledge, that this is definitely bad, and that somebody else who disagrees is simply wrong without any sort of proof. So as an appeal to noetic knowledge, it's fine. The only thing is, at this point, you've limited it to people who agree with you, that is to say, who see things in the same way. And this is a somewhat unfortunate point, simply because I don't think he actually has described a possible world. To make statements about worlds that can't actually exist is not very meaningful. Worlds that don't exist, fine. Math does that constantly. Worlds that can't possibly exist, that's a very different matter.
The moment you admit this, the moment you admit that the worst possible misery for everyone is the worst outcome, okay, then you have to admit that every other possible experience is better than the worst possible misery for everyone. So a continuum opens up. And because the experience of conscious creatures is going to depend in some way on the laws of nature, there are going to be right and wrong ways to move across this continuum. It will be possible to think you're avoiding the worst possible misery for everyone and to be wrong about that and to fail to avoid it. This is, in some sense, a navigation problem.
So far, this part actually does follow from what he said before, but it doesn't get you anywhere because he does not give a measure which can tell, which can sort anything else besides whether or not you are in the worst possible world. So you don't actually get anything practical out of this, even if you were to accept the things that he just said. And this is going to play out. He's going to develop this a bit, but it's going to play out.
So here is my argument for locating moral truth in the context of science. Questions of right and wrong and good and evil depend upon minds. They depend upon the possibility of experience. Minds are natural phenomena. They depend upon the laws of nature in some way. Morality and human values, therefore, can be understood potentially in the context of science, because in talking about these things, we really are talking about all of the facts that relate to the well-being of conscious creatures. In our case, we're talking about genetics and neurobiology and psychology and sociology and economics. Now, I view this space of all possible experience as a kind of moral landscape where the peaks correspond to the heights of well-being and the valleys correspond to the lowest depths of suffering. And one thing that to drop out of this analogy is the possibility of there being multiple peaks. Maybe there are many different but morally equivalent ways for, in our case, human beings to thrive.
Right there, you get into the problem. Because you don't have to have... Well, what really gets to be the problem is that that doesn't have to be true universally of everybody. It could be true of some people and not of others. That is to say, some people could have one way of thriving and other people could have a different way of thriving. And these people, you know, may well become enemies, especially if the one person's way of thriving becomes a value for the other people. So he starts off in a very, very simplistic way, which is a reasonable way to start. But he's... And I appreciated his beginning where he was being fairly clear, but here, unfortunately, he's glossing over the giant leaps he's doing, going from one to many and not looking in the fact that you've now introduced complex relationships.
But clearly there are more ways not to thrive. There'll be many more ways to not be on a peak.
Oh, and here's a classic thing. This is something Chesterton actually mentioned too. A real problem you run into with a lot of secularists is they have no real positive vision of the future. They just have a sense that some things are obviously really bad. And so they want to reduce all education down to essentially, I forget exactly how Chesterton put it, something to the effect of putting up the occasional signpost at points of particular danger, saying, you know, warning cliff here. The problem is that it keeps you from failing in the worst possible ways, but that's not very much.
And I think it's rather obvious that there are many more ways to suffer unnecessarily in this world than to be sublimely happy. Now, the Taliban are still my favorite example of a group of people who are struggling mightily to build a society that is obviously less good than others on all.
Okay, now, here again we come to, this is a part where he is assuming an amazing amount of stuff, because we are no longer, this is not stipulative. This is a claim he is making about the world that rests on a tremendous amount of knowledge that he doesn't have. I'll explain in a moment.
Offer. The average lifespan for women in Afghanistan is 44 years.
Of course, you have to ask why. If this is a particularly disease-ridden place, if this is a place where food is particularly hard to grow and so on, it doesn't really much matter what your societal arrangement is, especially if there are no natural resources you can use to trade with anybody, and nobody currently has the ability to produce really great semiconductor designs to sell, etc. So if you don't really have anything to sell and you live in an incredibly poor area that has various diseases, poisonous animals, etc., it may well be the case that there is no organization of society because you just haven't gotten lucky enough to have riches. He doesn't say. I'm not claiming that is the case or is not the case, but this is I am kind of aware that Afghanistan isn't exactly very rich in natural resources. In fact, one of the best things they have is illegal, opium. So, they have a ton of mountains, which are not exactly known for their arable land and so on. So, we do kind of know that Afghanistan was not exactly blessed with a tremendous amount of riches. So when he cites facts like this, he isn't giving any of the very important context to say how well could they be doing in this sort of circumstance.
Okay, they have a literacy rate of 12%. They have almost the highest fertility rate in the world and almost the highest infant and maternal mortality in the world. This is one of the best places on earth to watch women and infants die.
He's not saying why, and to say it's because of the Taliban is just to assume his conclusion. Mind you, I'm no fan of the Taliban, but in any event, he's just assuming his conclusion here. Well, it's not his conclusion in the broader sense, but he's just assuming this portion of his argument.
Also, GDP that's lower than the world average in the year 1820. So it seems to me patently obvious that the optimal response to this situation, which is to say the most moral response, is not to throw battery acid in the faces of little girls for the crime of learning to read.
You have to actually justify that. I'm not saying that is actually a good way of doing it, but the problem that he comes to here, I'm going to let him continue for a moment, then I'll say what the problem is.
Now, I think this is common sense to everyone in this room, and common sense it should be to everyone in the civilized world, except you, if you happen to be a bioethicist working on the President's Council at the moment. But this is also of necessity a claim about biology and psychology and sociology and economics.
Okay. The problem that he did not just address is that it is always possible in the, to use the analogy he gave before of the moral landscape with its peaks and valleys, that you are presently in some sort of valley. And if you, and next to you, there are only very small peaks, but if you cross some valley, there's a much, much higher peak on the other side. So you have to go down before you can get up again. But if you do so, you'll be much better off. And herein we come to the justification that every revolutionary has for bathing their country in blood. Occasionally, revolutionaries were right. American revolutionaries seemed to produce a better system than had been in place beforehand. And also didn't kill that many people to accomplish it compared to some things. On the other hand, how many people did Stalin kill? At least something like 40 million people, 50 million people. The entire USSR over its history killed somewhere in the neighborhood, I believe, about 40 million people. Murdered in the sense, I think about 20 million, if I recall correctly, were intentionally starved to death in, and I should remember this name. It's a very significant point in history, but I apologize for not remembering it. But were starved to death in Ukraine on purpose because it helped out. And this is where revolutionaries always have their arguments for all the horrible things that they do, that yes, we're descending at the moment, but it's because there's a much higher peak over there on the other side of this valley. And there is no particular way of resolving with complete certainty in this sort of sense whether or not that actually is the case, especially given how much is dependent on the actions of what people choose to do. So, while he's not entirely wrong in the sense of, I mean, he's looking for a natural law theory of morality, and insofar as he's doing that, he's correct. But the problem is, to do this on your own in this fashion, especially with the rubric he set up, does not allow you to make the sort of judgments he has just made, because it is possible that if you throw battery acid in the faces of little girls in order to keep them from reading, yes, that's bad right now, but over time you produce a society in which nobody tries, so nobody gets battery acid thrown anymore, so that problem goes away. I'm obviously playing devil's advocate here. And then over time, because they're not reading, other people will then, you know, be properly motivated to take care of them. You'll have much stronger family bonds, in which case you will have strong, resilient family units that, despite hardship, will actually help each other out as opposed to abandoning each other when external bad things happen. And therefore, once you really restructure society this way and nobody is trying to do the things they're not allowed to do, none of the punishments will be applied and all the benefits will be reaped. You'll be finally on that peak on the other side of the valley you had to trudge through. Now, I'm not saying that the Taliban are right. Obviously, the Taliban, by not being Catholic, are wrong. However, this is how they are thinking, and this is the argument to which Sam Harris would have no response, given the system that he set up. That he has no grounds on which to say there is not, in fact, a peak on the other side of this valley. I mean, he can declare it, as he just did, and say that, well, obviously we all know this to be the case. But at that point, you don't... By the time you simply directly know the answers to complex moral questions, I think he didn't actually appreciate the nature of the complexity, because this is, you know, the example he gave is part of a larger system, and he was addressing it as if it was the only thing, to be perpetuated on exactly as it is, rather than a way of getting to someplace else. But... as such, if you're going to just simply assume all of your moral conclusions in the manner not so much assume all of them, but just, you know, directly know all of your moral conclusions, there is no morality to be argued about. There's no point in invoking the science about it. I mean, he's not right here. You'll notice he's not citing anything. He did not cite any sort of study. He's not citing any sort of neurobiology. He's not citing any sort of psychology. He's simply saying that he knows that these things are obviously the case. And presumably he would answer that argument, answer that objection by saying that he's picking these sorts of things where you don't need to in order to give examples where you don't have to spend as much time, and on things where it's not as obvious, that's where you would then have recourse to the studies, which is sort of fair enough, except that the systems are too complex for studies to ever really answer them in this fashion.
It is not unscientific to say that the Taliban are wrong about morality. In fact, we have to say this the moment we admit we know anything at all about human well-being.
The fundamental problem with what he just said here being he hasn't actually cited any science whatsoever in order to back up his point. I mean, literally, the thing I just said kind of applies right here. Now, as I said, he probably means that, you know, you could, if you needed to, verify this obvious stuff, etc. But having said that, there's no scientific conclusion so far. This is just his common sense, not scientifically backed up.
Now, some people with a little philosophical training may begin to wonder, well, who's to say that if a father wants to burn his daughter's face off with battery acid, he's wrong in any objective sense? Okay, who's to say we should value the well-being of little girls? Who's to say that the father doesn't have an alternate but also legitimate conception of well-being? Now, moral skeptics of this kind invariably cite David Hume's famous distinction between is and ought. The notion is you can't get an ought from an is, which is to say that science can only give us a descriptive account of the way the world is, and there's no way to move from that account to an account of how the world ought to be. Now, I happen to think this is a trick of language. This notion of ought, this falls very much into Wittgenstein's notion of philosophy as a battle against the bewitchment of our intelligence by means of language. And people are mightily bewitched by words like ought and should and moral duty. Now, to ask whether we ought to avoid the worst possible misery for everyone, on my view, is nonsensical. If we ought to do anything, if we should do anything, if we have a moral duty to do anything in this universe, it's to avoid the worst possible misery for everyone.
Again, this is just him assuming his conclusion. There's actually another point, a much stronger counterargument to what he's saying here that he's not addressing at the moment, which is that since human beings are evolving, we're not all the same. And therefore, the bigger problem is, how would you scientifically prove that the hypothetical father and hypothetical daughter in this case have the psychological well-being that whatever, let's give him the benefit of the doubt, whatever psychological experiments he has performed on other people, what scientific experiment has he done that shows that this still applies to these people who are new and moreover, newly evolved? And this is highly relevant. They may well be mutations of some kind. We know they are not genetically identical to the other people that you have studied. And so how do you know that the genetic differences don't in fact matter to the morality in question? And he's got no answer. He's got no possible answer. There's no way to prove that this sort of uniformity is going to apply in spite of whatever changes may in fact happen.
Okay, there's no notion of ought that reaches deeper than the imperative of avoiding the worst possible misery for everyone.
Oh, he's also assuming the conclusion that there is an ought whatsoever at all, rather than ought being merely a conditioned reflex that doesn't actually mean anything. So he sort of did say up front he's assuming that's not the case, but he's largely throwing out the argument. He's largely throwing out the position of most of the people who disagree with him, because most people disagree with him not by saying that there is some natural law, but it's different for everybody, which is an answer, is something that he could not answer anyhow. And this is, incidentally, as I said in Atheist Morality, this is where you need a God, because God would have to create us as all being the same sort of thing. If we're evolving, then we're all different things that are related conceptually only because we choose to view each other as being related. We're more similar than we are to other things, but there's no way of knowing just how similar, because every new person is new and not something we have studied before, and just looks superficially from the outside like things that we have studied before. What you're actually doing is smuggling in essentially Platonic concepts of the human being, which do come from God, because God has the idea of the human being. We are a species. Well, really, in Thomistic language, we're a genus, of which each person is a species. There's an ironic change in language there. But the point being that you have no basis upon which to say that all human beings are alike before examining them, unless you have some reason to suppose they are going to all be alike. And given that evolution specifically says that all descendants are not going to be like their parents, you're in a really, really bad place here to do what he wants to do scientifically. And moreover, he's also at this point addressing practically nobody, because most everybody simply is saying that the viewing the worst possible world, as he stipulated it, as bad is simply a conditioned reflex that we have that doesn't mean anything. So we've kind of got the problems that he's not really actually talking to anybody. And most he's saying sort of what some of the implications of the meaningless conditioned reflex that we have are. And moreover, the thing that he is proposing to accomplish, natural law, can't possibly accomplish it. I mean, legitimately, you can, of course, assume anything you want and move on. But at that point, as long as you're assuming things simply because they're convenient, we get right back to religion's a lot cleaner way of doing that. I mean, even the fundamentalist. Well, I'm not talking about, Catholicism, which, actually demands that people try to find out what's true. But, just go for Christian fundamentalism. It's a lot simpler than the complex scientific way of eventually just assuming things anyway that he's proposing here.
It doesn't make sense to say, well, I would have avoided the worst possible misery for everyone, but I actually had other priorities. Okay, there's no space for those other priorities to occupy.
All right, I think I'm going to wrap up here, because this has been going on for a while. And you'll see again what he did right here, which is sort of a good note to end on, that he has retrenched from where the argument doesn't work at all, and where it's from his perspective, I think he'd call it, where it's, you know, very difficult to apply, back to something so basic that has gotten rid of all possible variables, that his argument is at least clear here. But as I said before, and this is the problem, this worst possible world versus every other world is not a useful distinction when comparing any other worlds. And clearly, if many people are happy, but one little girl has an acid thrown in her face, well, it's bad that acid was thrown in her face, that is not clearly the worst possible world, because the worst possible world stipulated all people suffering maximally. And in this case where the father is throwing acid in his little girl's face for learning to read, one has to ask how, incidentally. I mean, within this hypothetical, I mean, in the tribal sort of environment, where is she getting the reading material from, incidentally? But anyhow, leaving that out of account. I only bring that up because people often like to paint these sort of things to really try to make it bad. They bring up things that are really, you know, will happen on occasion, but are really strange in the environment from which they come. Because normally, in this sort of environment where little girls aren't supposed to read, no one's going to be giving them reading material and teaching them how to read. And so it'll never come up that they will have been trying to read, and you know, hence the batter gas in the face stuff will just never come up for virtually everybody. So it's not a major point, but it's something to bear in mind whenever you see this, then people go for those sort of examples. Extreme examples are clear, but on the other hand, it is worth remembering, if somebody is trying to make them out as being common, that they are, however, very uncommon. Moreover, even accepting everything he said in this case, there is absolutely zero reason to suppose that the father in this case is suffering maximally as well, and therefore, this is not a case of the worst possible world versus some alternative. This is two not worst possible worlds that he's trying to compare, and he has no basis upon which to compare them, which is basically why he doesn't try. So, alright, as I said, I'm going to wrap up now, because I think this covers all the relevant points. I want to reiterate that I respect Sam Harris for trying. There are other things he's done in other contexts for which I don't respect him, so this is not by any means a general endorsement of Sam Harris, but I want to praise him for actually sincerely trying and for sincerely caring about this question. I wish he had done a much better job of answering it, and I hope that someday his desire to try to find natural law will find where natural law really comes from, and a, you know, properly grounded natural law. But in any event, he does recognize certain important things as actually being important, and kudos to him for at least trying. That said, his attempt is a dismal failure, and it's a pity he didn't recognize it as being a dismal failure for the reasons that I had mentioned earlier. So, that was what I'm calling part two. It's a somewhat arbitrary division, but that was the meat of his argument. That's the real substance, and why it fails, why it just does not work to do what he's trying to do. But with, as I said, you know, throughout the caveat that he's looking for a natural law morality, and insofar as he's doing that, he's on the right track. He's just looking for it in the completely wrong place, because you can't possibly get it with the approach he's using. Nothing even similar to the approach he's using will actually get you a natural law morality. But natural law morality is, in fact, the way morality should be constructed. So he at least has a good instinct there, if he's looking for it in the completely wrong place. So, until next time, may you hit everything you aim at.